It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a House Republican is attempting to oust Speaker John Boehner. We'll check out that story and more in our weekly look at the latest in national politics.
First, the State Department of Natural Resources announced a major reorganization yesterday that would consolidate most of the responsibilities for water and air pollution into a single division. It would also streamline other areas. Critics are worried about the impact the changes could have on environmental regulation and about a recent reduction to the DNR budget resulting in staffing cuts.
WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach is with us for more on the story. He joined us from our studio in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Well, broad stroke, so what is this reorganization plan? What would change at the DNR?
Well, the items catching the most attention seem to be putting the watershed management duties, that's things like shoreland regulation, dam safety, wetlands protection, and runoff from farms, into a division called Business Support and External Services, also the Science Services Unit of the DNR. A scientist doing research, that area has been cut back under the budget, state budget that passed. That would also go under this business support and external services. It continues a trend that some critics have said the DNR is becoming too friendly towards business. The Walker administration has generally said, they want to serve businesses and other customers, and by helping them, businesses earlier in a process, keep them out of enforcement problems later on. But that's the thing catching the most is this business and external services. Also in the reorganization is that drinking and groundwater regulation would stay separate from watershed management and move over with air management and water quality. There's some reasons for that.
And what are the reasons that the DNR has given for those changes?
Well, they're saying that at the EPA level, air and water are often grouped, and often air pollution, of course, falls into water, so it makes some sense for those two to be linked. But they're also saying that this all is very much a way to make the agency better able to meet its customer needs.
And the water division, a lot of things you just mentioned are water related. There was a water division, as I understand it, that now is gone. Its tasks are being split into these different agencies or sub-agencies.
Right, and we should emphasize these are being right now called interim steps. I suppose they may go ahead as announced to the DNR employees yesterday. It could be possible that there'd be some change if there's enough public uproar, but so far we're saying these are interim.
And this business support and external services, what's their job before all these things get added to that? What are they responsible for?
Well, again, it's to meet the needs of businesses and permit reviews. There's been an effort to speed up permit reviews for various projects. I'm assuming this would continue, an effort to speed things up would continue. Again, it's a question of whether the DNR staff would be helpful in protecting the environment by helping businesses stay out of trouble, or whether there'd be political pressure and time pressure on the agency staff to okay things that might cause pollution problems later. That latter thing is what the critics are fearing in this.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee about changes announced at the DNR yesterday, reorganizations going on there. Chuck, you mentioned what critics are worried about a little bit here. Can you expand on that a little? Are they worried that things going into this business unit will have less impetus to protect water quality?
Well, talking with Kim Wright of Midwest Environmental Advocates earlier today, and she was noting that the DNR and EPA already don't see eye to eye completely on some air and water, especially water regulations in the state. The DNR was given a emphasis to make some changes in the last few years, and the environmental groups are saying all those changes haven't gone through yet. And so now you're trying to do this with either the water division sort of broken up into different parts, or the watershed management part under this more sort of business-friendly sounding unit. And the critics say this is going to slow things down in terms of getting up to compliance with what the EPA wants.
And one of the more recent controversies at the DNR is the elimination of that Bureau of Science Services you mentioned briefly earlier, which conducted research for the DNR. What kind of focus is there on that kind of research as we see it in this reorganization?
Well, according to a Milwaukee newspaper report, they got access, I think, to Kathy Stepp, the DNR secretary. Our requests to talk to anybody at the DNR on the record have so far not been answered. Stepp told the Milwaukee newspaper that, yes, research will continue, and she has said that all along throughout this cutback process, but now she's saying something called applied research. In other words, the presumption is it would be a little more targeted research, definitely something that management only wants, and not perhaps there's been this allegation that some of the research has gone into areas that management didn't want, and it's led to discoveries about pollution, potential pollution from the iron mine that has not been built up in the Ashland area. So, again, the research would presumably continue, although with fewer staff, and be more targeted and be under more management control, it seems.
Chuck, you've been covering environmental issues in Wisconsin for a long time. From that perspective, you know, this is front page news today. Does this look like a minor bureaucratic reshuffling, or is this something beyond what we would usually see?
Well, Kim Wright of Midwest Environmental Advocates calls this major, especially with the water regulations. Other critics are saying this well, in some ways, this is a cosmetic change, and they're saying that the real problem is that the DNR has hundreds fewer staff members than it did 10 or 15 years ago, and they're going to be harder pressed to catch up no matter how you rename these various divisions.
Is workload going down to the DNR as those job numbers go down, or are they doing what they've always done, just with fewer employees?
Well, there's some of both, I think. I think there's some of doing more with fewer employees, but even the agency management says the workload, some things have gone up. Certainly the increasing number of large-scale farms. There was a public meeting in Green Bay yesterday that Patty Murray covered that's been quite contentious. One of the contentious issues of the growth in factory farms. Certainly there's been also more animal disease issues that have come the DNR's way, and the thing called climate change. There's already been some additional work for DNR staff, although they don't often say it's climate change related. They don't use the terms, but they often have to do some things. And now is this federal EPA power plant plan, which if it goes through, if it's announced by the Obama administration, could lead to some more work for the air folks. So there's plenty of work for the DNR to do. They're looking at this Waukesha water diversion and so on. And again, the critics are saying there's not enough staff, no matter how you rename things. And if you make it more business, you know, business friendly are the names of these divisions, then what does it mean for the public?
Chuck, you mentioned these are interim changes. Do we know what the timeline is on putting them into practice and making them non-interim?
Well, you know, this announcement to DNR staff yesterday wasn't necessarily going to be coming out to the public view just yet, but I think it was leaked by some agency staff to the newspapers. Otherwise, there are plans for the DLT, Department Leadership Team. It's all about leadership these days. They're rolling these out to the various offices around the state. I think Green Bay is up next on Thursday. And they're saying that this process will go on for a while. There will be some input opportunities, and that the full changeover might not take place until 2016. Again, I think it may depend a little bit about not only public, how much public furor there is over this. I've tried to reach out to the DNR board to see if they're going to raise questions at an upcoming meeting. Have not heard back from the two top members of the board. And then there's also this presidential race going on as well with Governor Walker, whether his actions in this area garner attention.
Chuck, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach, reporter for WPR News, with us to talk about the reorganization of the DNR announced to DNR staff yesterday.
It's about summer recess time in Washington, at least starting this week. But yesterday, just a day before the break, North Carolina Representative Mark Meadows surprised his colleagues with an attempt to oust Speaker John Boehner.
It's our weekly look now at the latest in national politics. Also this week, Senate Republicans introduced legislation that would defund Planned Parenthood. And some Democrats harshly criticized the Obama administration's nuclear deal with Iran.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time. Hey, Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So this motion that Meadows used hasn't been used in a long time. What is it?
This sounds like Don Quixote to me, to be perfectly honest. I mean, what we have seen over the past few years is we hear these rumblings from Republicans, conservative Republicans, members of, who support the Tea Party, that every single year we're going to see, oh, John Boehner's going to be overthrown. We don't like what he's doing. He's compromising too much. And this year is no different. We just have some, you know, piece of parliamentary maneuver that no one has really heard of in forever, and no one really understands. And this guy does it because he just feels it's the right time to do it. And it's just ridiculous. John Boehner is not going to be overthrown. He's not going to be overthrown today. He's not going to be overthrown tomorrow. He's not going to be overthrown next year. He has the members who are necessary to keep him afloat as a speaker. And this is just some Tea Party supporter who is upset, who probably wants to appeal to some, you know, constituency or some fundraising group. And they just do this every year, and it's a waste of time because it's not going to happen, at least in the current environment in Washington.
Now, it sounds as though some in the GOP are upset with Mark Meadows because of the timing of all of this when there's so much debate going on around the Iran deal. Does this divert attention?
I mean, yeah, that's exactly it. Look, Republicans want to keep their eye on the ball. They want to keep their eye on Iran, and as you mentioned in the opening here, that they want to keep their eye on Planned Parenthood. And anything that's a distraction from that is a bad thing for them. And it takes up press. The Washington media covers it instead of covering Planned Parenthood or the Iran deal, and it points to Republican division. When Republicans want to be able to say we're unified and that we want to move forward on these important pieces of legislation for us, and anything else is just a distraction.
Now, Mark Meadows, in this motion, did drop a list of complaints with John Boehner. What did he have to say? What is he upset with?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, they're just really upset with, you know, Boehner compromising too much. I mean, it's very difficult to be able to tell what most of these people are very much upset about. You know, they are upset because they believe that Boehner is going after them, that, you know, they're stripping them of certain appointments, that they're trying to stop, you know, certain things that these different groups within Congress, you know, are doing, these different caucuses. They're taking subcommittee gavels, but all of these are really minor complaints, and most Republicans just don't think that they're very, very important, which is why you didn't see anybody supporting Meadows when he went after Boehner.
Now, is there any chance that this thing could gather some momentum over the August break, and come the end of it, there's something real here to talk about?
I mean, you know, anything is possible in the world of politics. I mean, if you had asked me a few months ago that Donald Trump would be leading the Republican primary, I probably would have said that you were crazy. So, you know, anything is possible. But, you know, we've seen this play out so many times before where, you know, we've seen members of the Republican caucus upset with Boehner, and much stronger efforts than this, you know, leading up to a new Congress when they, you know, do normally select a new speaker. And they have gone just absolutely nowhere. So why should this time be any different? If anything, this seems to be a weaker effort than those of past years.
We're going to move on to talk about the Iran deal right now. And Secretary of State John Kerry met with the House Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday. And it sounds as though there's been some pushback among Democrats. What is the scene like on this?
Well, you know, the real question that we're looking for here, that we're trying to answer, is whether or not that you can get a majority of the House and the Senate to vote against that. Remember, Republicans control each body. But what they need is a supermajority. They need to override a veto, you know, two-thirds. And there are going to be Democrats who are going to vote against the president on this, specifically Democrats who care a lot about Israel. So we're talking about, you know, members who represent Jewish constituencies. And there does seem to be some Jewish congressmen who are very hesitant on this deal, who are not very happy, who do not like the explanations that are being given to them. But the thing to keep in mind, again, is that they need not just a few Democrats, they need a number of Democrats to be able to override the veto. And when we're looking to key votes, like we're looking to Sandra Levin, who's a longtime Democratic Jewish congressman from Michigan, he's behind this. He is behind the president on this. So, yes, there are going to be votes against the president, but at least at this point, it doesn't seem like there are going to be enough votes to be able to override the president's veto.
Does it look so far as though the president is then, as you say, winning that war in terms of public support or congressional support, I should say, for the Iran deal?
Sure. I mean, you know, I guess it's your definition of winning, right? I think most people have a definition of winning is that you get more votes than you don't get. The president's not winning in that way, but he is winning in the way that's most important, and that is that he's going to have enough Democrats in his pocket to be able to sustain his veto.
And public support on this is slipping a little. For the president, though, is that going to matter?
Well, you know, obviously, I think if you're president, you want the people behind you. But the polling does indicate that, yes, there is some slippage. You know, there was a CNN poll out this week that had, I think it was 52% of Americans who said that they weren't in favor of the Iran deal, at least as it was described in the CNN poll. But remember, this is a president who is not facing re-election. This is a president who knows what he wants, and he wants this deal to come to pass. And I don't think that Americans who, to be perfectly honest, depending on how you ask the polling question, you're going to get different responses, which indicates that there's not a high knowledge base working with the American people here. I don't think he's going to care all that much.
We're getting the latest in national politics right now with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. And checking out some campaign news this week, Hillary Clinton made some headlines by determinedly not answering questions about where she stood on the Keystone XL pipeline. Where is that taking her right now?
Well, you know, this is one of the chief critiques of the Clinton campaign, whether it be this year or whether it be 2008 or whether it be ever, which is that she is a politician, that the Clintons are politicians. And what do politicians do? They stop, they pause, they look at the polling numbers. They don't want to say anything that's going to upset anybody. And so this is a perfect example of that. The Keystone pipeline polls very well in most of the polling among the general public, but it does not poll well among Democratic constituencies, especially Democratic activists. So Clinton in this situation sees that and is saying, I'm not going to answer that question until I need to answer it, in the hopes that most voters just won't care. And the truth is most voters probably won't care. This is not going to be something that's going to, you know, really stumble her. But it is part of a longer-term pattern of her, you know, being not afraid but not willing to issue positions, positions on issues. And those, when they come together, cumulatively they could mean something, but this individually isn't really going to hurt her, I wouldn't think.
I'm guessing Bernie Sanders, though, has not been stalling on this question. So is this something that could gain some steam and come back to hurt her?
Yeah, I don't remember the last issue Bernie Sanders stalled on. Maybe what ice cream to get at Ben and Jerry's. But, you know, he is obviously not going to stall on this issue, and he's clearly going to come out, you know, against the Keystone Pipeline. But you know, that makes it a difficult thing for her, obviously, when they face off in a debate. But Clinton's just so far ahead at this point and has so much support within the party, and the environment is just not that important an issue to most voters, and it's especially not that important of an issue to the voters that Clinton's counting on most, you know, minorities in big cities and just people who are more conservative within the Democratic base. They're certainly going to matter to the people that Bernie Sanders who are Bernie Sanders supporters, but they're going to vote for him anyway. So, you know.
Is it likely that this issue is still going to be out there, undecided by the time she or whoever else wins the election gets to the White House?
I mean, it's possible. I mean, look, it's Washington, D.C. They, you know, they couldn't pass a ham sandwich around, you know, the congressional body. So anything is obviously possible, especially in D.C. So it might not be decided. So she may eventually have to come about and issue a decision on this. But I think that she's going to wait it out in hopes that she doesn't have to issue a position on it and that it will just be what it is for her.
Now, lastly, Senate Republicans have introduced legislation to cut off federal funds to Planned Parenthood. Now, this is in the wake of two videos coming out about the donation of fetal tissue. Catch us up on where we are on this.
I mean, you know, what we are essentially seeing are, you know, are a number of Republicans who want to just, as you said, defund Planned Parenthood, and it's because of these videos that are coming out. And if there's one issue that tends to, you know, bring the Republican Party together, is that it's, you know, the anti-abortion party or the pro-life party. And this is a way in which you can unify Republicans a lot, and you get a lot of money that's flowing in to the Republican Party from pro-life groups, and Republican, core Republican voters are very much pro-life. Unfortunately for them, there are at least a sliver of Republicans, such as Susan Collins up in Maine, who are going to, you know, oppose this measure. And more than that, in order to defund Planned Parenthood, you're going to have to obviously overcome, you know, a filibuster potentially from Democrats in the Senate. And more than that, you'd have to overcome the president's veto, which is just not going to happen. They're just not the votes there. So to me, this is one of those things where, yes, it's certainly an issue that should be debated, and Republicans are going to debate it, and they're going to try and bring Republicans together, but it's not anything that's actually going to happen. They are not going to be able to defund Planned Parenthood, at least with the current political environment and current videos that are out right now.
How much money does Planned Parenthood get from the federal government?
Good amount, but a lot of it is, you know, remember, a lot of this is for other things that Planned Parenthood does. You know, they're not just an abortion provider. You know, they provide a lot of quote-unquote health, you know, benefits or, you know, health procedures to women. And a lot of the money that is given to Planned Parenthood is specified to be used for those purposes. That's obviously not often discussed because I think most people think of Planned Parenthood as the abortion provider, or, you know, providing people with the knowledge of how, you know, how to plan for potentially one. But that's one of the things I think is often missed in this discussion, that a lot of the money is set aside not just for, you know, abortions, but for other medical procedures and medical advice.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's not hard to find unethical behavior in the world around us. There are a lot of examples of government officials, corporate leaders, popular athletes, and others bending or breaking the boundaries of ethical behavior. But where do we go to find examples for good ethical behavior?
One possible solution? Go to the experts, the people who make their living studying, thinking about it, teaching the subject. Ethic professors around the country spend so much time exposed to these discussions, so you'd think they might hold themselves to a higher ethical standard.
Not necessarily, according to our next guest. Eric Schwitzgebel is a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. His recent piece on this topic, called Cheeseburger Ethics, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So when you started asking ethics professors and researching their behavior, did you expect that maybe, hey, these ethics people are going to show more signs of ethical behavior?
I thought it was possible. I wasn't sure exactly how it would turn out. They certainly spend a lot of time thinking about ethical issues and sometimes have pretty strong moral opinions you might think they would act in accord with.
And what kind of questions did you cover with these experts?
So I've looked at a variety of different kinds of behavior. One set of measures asked them to evaluate the morality of different types of behavior and then self-report their own behavior on those same issues. Other things that we've done is look directly at their behavior without looking at self-reports.
And so you're talking about things like what? Donating to charity? What other kinds of behavior?
Right. So in the self-report measures, we looked at donating to charity, at vegetarianism, whether they embrace the idea that you shouldn't eat the meat of mammals, and we looked at whether they were likely to call their mothers. We looked at responding to student emails. We looked at whether they voted in public elections, whether they were blood donors, those sorts of things, several measures like that.
Was it one, did you join or were you sympathetic with the Nazi party?
Yeah, so another study that we did was we looked at historical records from the 1930s on the rate at which philosophers joined the Nazi Party or were in some way severely punished by the Nazis. And we found that professors of philosophy were at least as likely as professors in other academic departments to be involved with the Nazi Party and more likely to be Nazi Party members than were members of the general public at that time.
Now that's a pretty huge question. With all the other things you looked at, though, what was the bottom line? How did they measure up? Are these ethics professors better than the rest of us?
So we did not find, so most of this is with collaboratively with Josh Rust at Stetson University, I should say. We did not find that Ephesus behaved any differently, any better or worse overall than any of the other groups of participants we looked at.
Now, informally, you spoke to some religious leaders about whether these people in the religious community would be more ethical. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, so regularly whenever I meet someone who is a clergy member in some religion, I ask whether that person thinks that clergy behave any better than lay people in the same religion. And what I've found universally is that the clergy will say no to that. Typically they'll say, well, they might say that clergy behave about the same. Some of them will say that clergy actually behave a little worse. I haven't yet had any clergy tell me that clergy behave better than lay people, although I'm sure some probably do have that opinion.
So, Eric, I'm a little worried here. The people you'd expect maybe to be more ethical aren't. So I guess the big question is why? Why don't these people who spend all their time wrestling with ethics and moral quandaries, why don't they take that mental work and translate it into real life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure why that's the case. I think there are several possible explanations. I think one possible explanation is that most people do not aim to be morally better than their peers, particularly. They aim to be about the same morally as their peers, right? So if you see other people cheating and getting away with it, then you want to cheat and get away with it too. So we're not aiming maybe to be saints, and that might include ethics professors and even clergy. They want to do what everyone does. So you look around, you might see your moral standards changing. You might decide, well, look, people should give more to charity, or maybe people should be vegetarian, or people should be really conscious about participating in democracy, those sorts of things. But if you don't see other people around you doing that same thing, you might think, well, why should I if other people are not?
Talking to Eric Schwitzgable. He's a philosophy professor, and he's delved into the issue of ethical behavior, asking the question, do people who study ethics, who research this, behave better than the rest of us? Short answer, no, not really. We want to hear from you and how this plays out in your daily life at 800-642-1234. If you think you're an ethical person, where did that come from? What motivates it for you? And why do you think, even if we think about this stuff, why don't we always live up to our own ethical standards? 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
And Eric, do you think there could be anything going on here that would be similar to carbon credits? In this case, you know, you think about ethics, you study ethics, therefore you get a little license to be a little less ethical because you're thinking about it.
Yeah, so there is some evidence in the psychological literature for what's sometimes called moral licensing or moral self-licensing. The idea that when you do something good, that gives you some permission to do something bad a little later. So if you do something good, such as buy an environmentally green product, the evidence suggests that you might then be a little less cooperative or nice in a subsequent interaction with someone else because you kind of like just proven to yourself, hey, I'm pretty good, right? If we're aiming for mediocre, which is, I think, one possibility, you know, if people are aiming for mediocre and then they do something that's good, then that they give themselves a little bit of a license to do something a little bad later on because otherwise, you know, they'd be maybe aiming a little too high.
Now, if the ethics experts and anyone else has this gap between their ethical belief system, their moral beliefs, and how they actually behave, how they don't live up to it, I mean, does that make us all hypocrites? Can we be judgy about ourselves on this?
You know, I don't like the word hypocrite in this context. I think I actually admire people who have high moral standards, even if they don't live up to them. So take someone who maybe has very high standards for environmentalism, an issue you just raised, right, but doesn't quite live up to them. Compare that person with someone who says, I don't care about the environment at all, and engages in all kinds of polluting behavior, right? I like the, I think in the second case, not necessarily more admirable person than someone who has high standards but doesn't quite live up to them.
Why do you think people don't want to take the moral high ground, especially these people who study ethics, because apparently it fascinates them? Why do you think these people especially don't want to be the examples for everyone to look up for? Why are even they aiming for mediocrity?
Well, I think some people, are really invested in seeing themselves as morally far superior to their peers. But those people are often not, in fact, superior. And maybe the rest of us see ourselves as, you know, morally okay, morally B+, maybe not super wonderful, but also hopefully, you know, pretty good. It might be, to really be a saint might require more sacrifice than people are willing to make.
Let's bring a caller in on this. We've got Sherry on the line in Madison now. Sherry, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you think, Sherry?
The comment I have regarding ethical behavior among ethicists is that it is much easier to be judgmental or have a judgment about someone else's ethical behavior than it does your own. You can always defend what others would see as unethical behavior.
And do you have a first-hand experience in this field, Sherry?
Well, I am on an ethics commission in a county and have been on an ethics committee in a healthcare setting where we would deal with end-of-life decisions. But I do say being on an ethics commission and that being an important personal value, when I'm about to do something that might have ethical implications, it does give me pause.
Sherry, thanks a lot for that call. So she's in a little more of a hands-on position maybe than the ethics professor, Eric, and she says the experience setting in ethical standards for others makes her think twice in some of her own behavior.
Right, and that seems right, but she also said something that kind of might counterbalance that to some extent, right? So she started by mentioning that people, that it's very easy to come up with justifications or rationalizations for your own behavior. Easier maybe than, and it's easy to judge other people and to kind of excuse yourself. So I'm kind of inclined to think that there might be two kind of competing factors here for people who are on ethics commissions and for people who are ethics professors, right? One is an enhanced salience of and perhaps interest in theoretical ethics, which might push you toward better moral behavior, right? But on the other hand, there might be an increased capacity or interest in or availability of different manners of excusing oneself, where you can come up with, if you're a good, talented enough ethicist, you can come up with a theory to defend almost anything, right? So those two pressures might approximately counterbalance in a way that the behavior ends up not changing.
Sherry, thanks a lot for the call. And we go next to Davriel in Eau Claire. Hi there.
Hi.
What do you think about this ethical quandary?
Well, so I think it's important, I mean, similar to your previous caller, to understand the role that the people's own personal justifications of their behaviors have. So I've spent some time in the military, and something that they really preach is the role of bystanders and, you know, their ability to positively alter a situation. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is to not absolve yourself based on the actions of those around you, but to look at a situation singularly as yourself and just question, what will I do? As opposed to, you know, what are others around me doing?
Great point. Thank you for that, Davriel. And is that something people should be thinking about as they consider their ethics, not to judge against the herd, but to chart their own moral path forward?
Yeah, I do think that that is an important factor that can lead one to behave morally better than one otherwise would. On the other hand, of course, it can also go the other direction. I kind of, since my empirical data suggests that there's no change overall, usually when I see something that is good, I also think about what the flip side of it might be. And one flip side of kind of moral independent thinking is that the herd might be right. and when you're thinking independently of the herd, you might, if you're inclined to justify something that you want to do that most people might think was bad, right? But you're an independent thinker, you arrive at your own moral judgment. It might be a wrong moral judgment that's kind of self-flattering, self-excusing. So independent moral thinking, I think, is a two-edged sword.
Hmm.
Not that I discourage it, but I think we want to, you know, just recognize that.
We're talking to Eric Schwitzgebel. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside, about ethics and ethical behavior. He's done some philosophical research. He found that people who study ethics aren't necessarily more ethical than anybody else. So studying the stuff doesn't make us better people. What could?
And we want your answer to that question at 800-642-1234. What makes you behave ethically? Is it your religious belief or maybe a personal philosophy? Do you have a role model? Do you take the time to ponder ethical dilemmas? And if so, do the answers you come up with actually shape the way that you behave? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with philosophy professor Eric Schwitzgebel. In a recent piece, he says people who study ethics for a living don't necessarily behave more ethically than anybody else. And we're asking, what motivates you to behave ethically or not?
Call in with your answer to that question now at 800-642-1234 or share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right back to our callers now. We've got David on the line in Green Bay. David, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
So I think it's really difficult for a lot of people who don't study ethics for a living to be able to understand, and I'm not just saying this as a person who really likes to think that I know everything about ethics, but to understand all the different things that play into being able to make ethical judgments at all. So to start with the premise that ethicists don't act as ethically as people who don't study ethics as much takes for granted the fact that ethicists all think that what everybody else thinks about common sense morality is true or apt about what we believe. So I, for example, study ethics an awful lot, and a lot of times I'm coming to conclusions like, well, maybe an awful lot about what people think is a good action or a bad action don't actually apply at all. And so if I actually believe there are moral truths, I'm going to act very differently than a lot of people who don't believe there are moral truths. And there are ethicists on both sides. And a lot of ethicists have to spend their entire lives trying to debate other ethicists who don't believe that there are moral truths to convince them that there are.
Interesting, David. I want to bring Eric Schwitzgebel in on this now. Eric, maybe ethicists don't live up to what we would define as ethical standards, but do they live up to their own standards, the ones that they established maybe in their own idiosyncratic ways?
Right. The evidence that we have, Josh Rush and I have, suggests that they don't live up to their own standards either, right? So we did find some issues where ethicists on average have very different opinions from non-ethicists. For example, the majority of the ethicists we surveyed said that it was morally bad to eat the meat of mammals such as beef or pork, and that was only a small minority opinion among the non-ethicists that we surveyed. And yet they self-reported eating meat at the same rate, both groups. So
I don't know about these ethicists.
So whether you look at kind of more conventional standards or, to the extent we can, whether you look at their own standards, it doesn't seem to be much difference in the behavior, at least on the measures we've looked at so far.
Let's go next to Sherry, who joins us from cable. Sherry, hi.
Hi. I believe that when you're a child and you grow up with your parents as role models, hopefully good role models, for 18 years of your life, you formulate a good ethics base if you are being role modeled that. And secondly, I believe faith is huge in your ability to do what is the right thing to do.
Sherry, thank you for those thoughts. She's talking about the parental role there that our ethical grounding takes because of our parents, our upbringing, and also faith. So to take that last angle, did you look at all about ethicists who were adherents to particular religions? Any differentials there?
So I haven't looked at ethicists' religious affiliations, but there is a literature in social psychology on the relationship between religiosity and different kinds of ethical behavior or criminal behavior. And the findings there are disputed. My particular reading of them is that the religiosity is not very predictive of moral or immoral behavior. Now, that there may be some forms of religiosity that are predictive, but it seems like if so, there are other forms of religiosity that might be negatively predictive, right? Religion can be an occasion to be motivated to act morally, but it can also be an occasion to privilege your group over someone else's group or satisfy certain kinds of moral standards while rejecting others.
Talking ethics with Eric Schwitzgable. And next on the line, we have Nick in Wauwatosa. Nick, hi.
Hi.
Nick, hi. Go ahead.
Yes. I had a mentor as I was a young man, and I look at ethics through a personal self-interest. I guess you could almost say a selfish perspective, in that if I, which happened to me not too long ago, walked out of the store without paying for something, I feel like a thief if I don't go back. And so I'm doing things because I want to feel good about myself. I'm not a saint. I'm not into necessarily self-sacrifice, but from a personal self-interest perspective, because it builds my self-image and I feel better about
Nick,
myself.
Thanks for the call, Eric. So a selfish motivation for virtuous ethical behavior.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call that selfish. I would call it emotional, right? Mm-hmm. So if you feel good about doing something good for someone else and feel bad about doing something bad, then some people think of that as a kind of selfishness. But I think we should call that, having a good kind of moral, emotional alignment. So he's maybe a little too self-critical along those lines.
All right, so you're a good person. Thanks a lot for that call. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
That was Eric Schwitzgable. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. We've got a link to his recent piece on ethical behavior. It's called Cheeseburger Ethics, and the piece explains why he calls it that there, by the way. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can keep sharing your thoughts and maybe your experiences while you're there. I'd love to see what you think.
Let us know if you're selfishly ethical or
yeah.
Ethically selfish.
Whoa.
I don't know.
I don't know what that means, but it
that
sounds
means
really
either.
Deep. That's
well,
cool.
Well, you can let us know your stories over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Governor Walker ran into an occupational hazard on the campaign trail that every candidate has to deal with at some point. How to eat the local food in an unfamiliar place.
The place? Philadelphia. The food, the Philly cheesesteak and the faux pas. Witnesses say the governor cut in line, and worse, he ordered his cheesesteak with American cheese and no onions. Philadelphia reacted poorly. Apparently, it has to have the onions to be considered legit, and the classic cheese of choice is not American cheese, but Cheese Whiz.
Cheese Whiz. I didn't know that. According to some media reports on that, going back to the past, John Kerry, in the run-up to his presidential campaign, ordered Swiss cheese on his cheesesteak, also apparently a no-no.
So we're wondering, what would an outside politician get wrong if they were eating food here in Wisconsin? What would create this kind of uproar?
I'm sure this has happened one way or another. The first thing that popped to mind would be getting the brat and putting ketchup on it. That would, I think a lot of people would react poorly to that.
Which I have done. I will admit to that right now.
Oh, yeah. And I've had it too, but there are people, you know, gasping with dismay at that confession right now. Fortunately, I'm not now, nor probably will I ever run for office. So I'm safe.
Having a glass of wine with a brat.
Yeah, wine with brat.
That would be wrong.
Is there some kind of cheese curd violation that we might point toward? Like a fried cheese curds with a fork? Yeah.
That would not be cool.
Or complaining about the squeakiness of a fried
cheese.
This cheese is too squeaky. Send it back. Don't do that if you're running for office. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.